Good evening, everyone.
Evening.
Before the public health situation kind of imploded, I had the little penance before I would come to visit Valley Streams. I had the little penance of riding the train to Sacramento. And I don't have that. So it's like, it's almost too easy to turn on the computer and join all of you. I don't travel particularly well, as our Tonto Jim Hare can testify, since we went to China together. Well, it wasn't too bad, but anyway, travel is not my thing, so I can sit here in the so-called the Hojo, the abbot's quarters at Isanji, One Mountain Temple here in San Francisco, and I'll talk to you where it's pretty cool, and I think it's not so cool in Sacramento at the moment, something tells me. Years ago, when I was in graduate school, one of my teachers said that one point of view is that psychotherapy is either for better or for worse. It's not just some sort of neutral thing that can happen without any effect. If it's for better, great. But if so to speak, nothing happens, in a sense, that's for worse. Because then the trust in the process is probably damaged. So that's just one point of view, but I started wondering, is Buddha Dharma for better or for worse? So I don't know. I was puzzling about this because I gave a talk a while ago, and someone told me afterwards. Someone sent me a message and said, "Are you all right?" And I replied, "Well, yes, I think I'm all right." And this person said, "Well, your talk was really depressing." Oh no, that's terrible. What if Buddha Dharma is always for better or for worse, and that talk was for worse? Oh dear. I shall be paying that karmic debt for untold kalpas, if that's true. But I was also a little surprised because I kind of went over the talk in my mind as much as I could. I often don't remember very well what I said, and I don't write it down, so it tends just to sort of disappear. But I did remember mentioning some things that were in our world that were rather troubling. And I was a little surprised that this person who's a fairly experienced practitioner had that reaction, because I thought, well, wait a minute, we're Buddhists. And Buddhism is famous for not sugarcoating our reality. So talking about the situation of the homeless or people of color or the degraded environment, and so forth. I would be surprised if Dharma students took that as depressing rather than, well, I don't know, sobering something like that. And yet I also knew that in my position, I have to be especially careful in what I say, which is kind of it's a bit of a burden sometimes. I was remembering when I was living at Green Gulch, and I was passing another student who was, we were passing each other going in and out of the dining room. And as he went in, he greeted me cheerily. And then he said, "What are we going to do, Myo?" And I said, without thinking, "We're going to die, Anthony." And he stopped rather suddenly. And I didn't think anything of it. I just went about my business. And not long after, he left Green Gulch. And I thought, I didn't associate that with me particularly. I was sorry to see him go. He was a very sweet guy. But later he sent me a message and said that exchange we had caused him to leave Green Gulch and to pursue his great love, which was ceramics, being a potter. And I thought, my goodness, if I'd known that that was even possible, I wouldn't have said anything, probably. And that reminded me of my first teacher, Zen Tatsu, and the introduction he wrote to one book of translations, where he asks the rhetorical question, you know, he says, on what moments has your life turned? So that's kind of an interesting question. That was clearly a moment in Anthony's life where it turned. And we have those moments. And whereas I think there's a little mythology in Zen that the great Zen masters, you see, they can kind of contrive such moments and due to extraordinarily sensitive spiritual antennae, they can say just the right thing at the right time and the student's mind will open. But I have to say, I think that is mythological. It's much more like what happened between me and Anthony. Two or more beings come together. They have an exchange, and the causes and conditions are such that something suddenly comes up, or opens, or falls away. And from then on, the person's life is somehow different. So I have been wondering, asking silently asking people I meet, on what moment has your life turned, and did you notice, or are you noticing? One example that Zen Tatsu gives in the book is he just says, the fleeting smile of a baby. That's one turning moment, possibly, for someone. Someone, a guest speaker, gave a talk here at our temple, that is to say, Zoomed into us on the Saturday and gave a talk and was referring to one of our Zen poems, which uses the expression a pivotal moment. A pivotal moment. As a matter of fact, all moments are pivotal. And recognizing this is one of the gifts of our practice. It may seem that we are, we're surrounded by ordinariness. In a way, that's true. But every moment has its pivot. We're studying what's sometimes called mind-only Buddhism in our study hour here on Thursday evenings, and they have this expression, the Sanskrit expression, the asraya paravrti, which means the revolution of the basis. Referring to when the sort of the fundamental point of view changes from obsession with the constructed self and opens out into the limitless universe. There's a tendency to associate that expression, the revolution of the base, with attaining great enlightenment, but it also has something to say about every moment of our lives. Every moment that revolution is possible, and you might say is even happening. So our practice is to sit down in the midst of that revolution as it happens and position the body-mind as though our obsession with the convenient self were suddenly opened out into the great universe, or were seen to open out into the great universe. And the the sensitivity to that process is what makes the richness and possibility of all of these pivotal moments come to life. This fellow, Anthony, at Green Gulch, whom I had that exchange with, he'd been practicing a while, not terribly long, but long enough so that when the turn happened, he was there for it. He was watching. I actually wasn't, to be utterly embarrassed about it. I had just had breakfast, headed back to my trailer. But subsequently, I was honored to have been there when that tectonic shift happened for him. So possibly, in a sense, the Buddha Dharma is for better or for worse. And if so, then we should be very, very careful with each other and with ourselves. Some of you know the story of our ancestor, Dongshan, who took his leave of his teacher before his appreciation for the Buddha Way had really blossomed. I think his teacher was rather sad, but Dongshan was always a bit full of himself, actually, kind of a smart ass, and so before Dongshan left Yunyan, his teacher. They sat together for a while in silence, and I think the last thing that Yunyan said to Dongshan, his student, was I think he addressed him as Hoshang, and Hoshang is a term of respect for a Buddhist monk. So he said, Hoshang, having assumed the burden of this great matter, you must be very, very careful. So I think he was reminding Dongshan that it's for better or for worse. In a sense, everything counts. Some of the mistakes that teachers have made in recent years have had very, very serious karmic consequences. It's like, well, they should have known better. Well, for fear that I'm about to get depressing again, maybe I will ask for if someone would like to ask a cheerful question or make a comment. I don't know who the engineer is, but can the engineer manage?
Yes. Huh? I'll be the engineer.
Okay, great.
Oscar is raising his
hand. Okay, yes, Oscar.
Thank you very much, Myung, for pointing out the criticality of every moment. That's one of the things that I sometimes remember but usually forget. So I really appreciate being reminded. My question is regarding Anthony. Was the situation for better or for worse at that turning moment?
Well, New York. I'm inclined to say it was for better. Mm-hmm. He was able to, as somebody said, follow his bliss. Mm-hmm. And I think that turned out well for him. Mm. Fortunately.
Mm. I thought so too.
Yeah. Of course, only the Buddhas can see the whole chain of causes and conditions. So, but I could, for the part I could see, I would say it turned out well.
So why do you think then that maybe this occurred before you became a Zen master? But I think that's an arbitrary, maybe an arbitrary distinction. So why do you think Zen masters aren't more likely to create such moments, speaking without thinking? We're going to die, Anthony.
Could you say the question again?
I doubt it, but at some point you said you thought it was a myth. There is a myth.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah. I think what is true is that it's true for all practitioners that there is a sensitivity to the moment that makes a variety of outcomes possible. And responding to that sensitivity becomes, so to speak, second nature.
Yes.
And the so-called teachers, which is that is a whole other topic there. The so-called teachers have been asked by usually any number of people to make that sensitivity available and to meet people there and to live together and practice together with people in a way that honors that sensitivity.
Yes.
And that's the situation. Do you look at and see, teacher and students. So from that point of view, that's okay. I just don't think that there are necessarily, there's the old Zen saying that, Master Baijong snaps his fingers in the mountains in vain. I don't know if you heard that one.
No.
Yeah. That means, Baijong, great Zen master Baijong, whose least gesture could bring to enlightenment, a half a dozen people. It's like, well, not always. So he's off there in the mountains with his students snapping his fingers in vain and nothing's happening.
Doesn't that happen all the time? His teacher's always pointing at the moon. Maybe not always, but
if so, that's probably all to the good. If the teacher is always pointing to the moon, or the teacher is the one who happens to be pointing to the moon in that moment.
And there are stories, I can't quote them, but you probably will remember them, of teachers, of dialogues, and the teacher saying, "You understand, right? You really understand?" "No, teacher, I really don't." "You must understand." "I really don't understand.
I don't get it." That's right.
So that happens too.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much.
Brendan, it looks like you would like to speak.
Yes, thank you, Doralee. And thank you, Reverend, for being here and for your talk tonight. I really do relate with what you're speaking about because sometimes in my experience, the more understanding I gain, the experience can be very painful of letting go and opening up sometimes, you know, it's the further you think you're getting along the path and you think you're doing quite well, and, you know, you kind of turn a corner and you realize your ego has kind of been sharpening the knife for you, you know, and it's, so that's kind of how I took what you were talking about. I hear the quote all the time in my head, or some version of it, the you know, better not to begin, but if you begin, better to finish. And I was just kind of wondering, when you say be careful, that's something that I would like to learn how to do better, is, does that have to do with surrendering? Because I feel that some of this pain and anxiety is about opening up, but some of it also me is sort of always allowing a part of myself to hold back and not fully give myself over. So is that a way to be careful, or how would you advise us to be careful?
Well, I think Yunyan was reminding Dongshan that every moment is critical in some sense. That doesn't mean that we have to manage some great performance. Just that as we travel the world, if we bring that awareness with us moment by moment, we will naturally be careful. And if we can do that, even some of the time, that's really, really very good. In my experience, most of the anxiety that I associated with practice was from getting out ahead of myself, so to speak. And being unwilling to recognize the richness of each moment, moment after moment, instead of trying to reach ahead to some great resolution of everything, where everything was going to be just fine, and compared to which now it was really crummy. And this tendency of Dharma students to imagine an ideal future creates a lot of unnecessary tension. The present is the source of limitless riches. And if we relate to the present moment that way, the tendency to dwell either in the past, which of course is gone, or a future whose final shape we have no knowledge of, that tendency is diminished. And our practice of sitting, of taking our seat in the moment as it unfolds, breath by breath, heartbeat by heartbeat, is extremely helpful in that regard. So I don't know if I'm speaking to your question adequately. If not, please, you can ask again.
No, I appreciate your answer very much. Thank you.
Seeing any hands raised, but I may be missing something, so please speak up.
Yeah, it seems pretty quiet. So, oh, there goes Kenny, I think.
Yeah, I was just sitting here thinking of an anecdote or a moment when I was a chaperone for a week-long field trip for one of my sons, and I was, you know, telling the kids one day, make sure you put on sunscreen. And I asked this one kid specifically, hey, have you put on sunscreen? And he looked really surprised. And I got the impression that he'd sort of been homesick or something, or no one had been paying attention to him, or he had no parental attention. I was not really doing my job because I wasn't paying attention to him until I was just kind of perfunctorily making sure they wouldn't get sunburned on my watch. But it was kind of struck me like, wow, there are people that, you know, depended upon me. And this kid was feeling like he was away from home or whatever. And all I had to say was this one little thing. And not that it changed my life or anything, but I remembered that I had certain, power to pay attention to what was going on with the kids and try to be more parent to them when I was a chaperone. Mm-hmm. And that's my story. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Kenny. Uh-huh.
Karen would like to speak. Mm-hmm. Karen, you have to unmute yourself. Oh, okay.
Yeah, there you go.
It's actually Jim because my computer failed for some reason. So I'm in here. But I was intrigued that I never heard this story about, maybe this isn't so important to people, but intrigues me that you said that this old guy Dongshan was kind of a smart aleck, or wasn't taking things potentially too seriously. I was curious. I never heard a story about him not taking things too seriously. Maybe you could tell such a story.
I'm not sure he wasn't taking things seriously. He was just kind of full of himself. And a lot of his answers to, or exchanges with his teacher and with others, show that he was pretty good at the talk, but the walk had yet to mature. So in what, from my perspective, and of course this is all my projection that I'm just inventing, treasure trove of our Zen stories, for me, is an absolutely delightful playground that I can reinvent any way I please. So I visualize the parting between Yunyan and Dongshan as very poignant moment, especially for the teacher. And they had this little dialogue where Yunyan is kind of asking Dongshan, well, where are you going to go? And he says, you're not going to go home again, are you? And Dongshan says, no, I'm not going to go home. And then Yunyan says to him, you know, if you leave, it will be rather difficult for us to meet again. And Dongshan says, it will be very difficult for us not to meet again. Which is, you know, this like stupid sort of Zen student answer, right? Given the poignancy of that moment, to have this flippant answer like that, we will have to meet again, basically sidestepped what Yunyan was trying to tell him, which basically was, I'm not going to be around much longer. So this was sort of, this comes up more than once. Dongshan's kind of these snappy responses that don't actually come from his heart. So that is how I construe the situation anyway. And if you read the record of Dongshan, there's a kind of there's a shift in that. Once he does have his awakening, whatever that is, and indeed, he does not ever see Yunyan again. So this is just my take on things.
Thank you.
I thought, Larry, did you have your hand up?
Yes, thank you, Dorley. Thank you for your talk, Reverend Mio. I always enjoy listening to you. I wonder if you can speak to, well, as I recall, I've heard teachers talk about, well, to borrow the famous logo from Nike, just do it. Or teachers who will say, you know, you deliberate, you have to have more confidence in just in acting. And that seems to be the other side of carefulness in acting. So is it two different issues entirely, or is there a balancing there?
Well, I think what is meant, or I think what you're referring to is our teachers are urging us to move the body mind in the ways of practice over and over again without worrying about it so much.
Yes.
Without trying to figure out, well, where am I now compared to last week? Or where am I going to be next week? Or am I enlightened yet? You know, just to keep moving the body in the ways of practice over and over and over is what reveals the magic, I guess, something like that. Mm. So that's the sense of just do it. It's not so much, I don't think it's so much the way an acting coach would tell the acting student, you know, you got to get out there and inhabit the role. Or maybe it is, I don't know. But
yeah.
It's more about just do it is like, maybe Suzuki-Reshi would say, you know, when you hear the han, you go to the zendo over and over and over again. And don't worry, just do it. And that is a great truth there.
Yeah. So thank you. So I think that it's really a completely different issue than what you were addressing today.
Maybe so. Maybe.
Yeah. Thank you.
Well. I thank. Oh, sorry. Is there Oscar? Do you have another comment?
You have to unmute yourself, Oscar.
Thank you, Dorley. Thank you, Mio. I sort of have a question. It doesn't seem to me that it is a different thing, kind of. You know, responding to Larry. I thought, because what I, so my idea about it, about being careful, is to realize that every moment is pivotal. Mm-hmm. To proceed in the way of practice, in the way of great care, of infinite holding of everything. And so, because this is everything. Because each moment can open Buddha's treasury of the Dharma eye.
Mm-hmm. I think that's more or less what I was saying too.
I see. Yes, I thought so too.
Yeah.
And
we agree.
We agree. And Larry makes the point, I wasn't saying we didn't agree. I did that.
Right.
What I was trying to clear away the weeds in my mind was to address Larry's point. But how about We're reading a text now, for instance, where there's an emphasis by a master of action, acting, mm-hmm. go, you know, do. And we see this in many teachings. But there's no less care in that. The moment moves forward with us, with our practice, and we're always aware, action or no action, it's the same. There's no distinction in terms of this could be a pivotal moment or not, depending mm-hmm. on the attention we bring to this moment. Instead of, just as you said before, getting ahead of ourselves, that's where I'm always at. Almost always, you know, ahead of myself.
Okay.
I guess that's it.
Okay, thank you. Well, maybe that's enough for now. Thank you for gathering all your electrons together so we could see each other in this odd way. And, please continue to take care of yourselves and one another.